I gather that you're all fairly used to meditating, and that you are therefore know the basics. And one of the things that happens in meditation is that it doesn't go quite as we wish, or it goes, we think it's going well and it's not really going well in some sense. So what I'm going to talk about today is an important topic which is very useful to have at our fingertips, really, and that's while meditating, and that is the five hindrances. These are taught often, but quite early on in meditation courses and classes, because they are so basic. Everybody has, pretty much everybody has these hindrances arise, and they can be a great distraction in our meditation. And the question is how we deal with them. And so what I propose to do today is talk about the five hindrances: sense desire, hatred, ill will or annoyance, sleepiness and sluggishness, restlessness and remorse, and finally doubt. And I'll go through each one and suggest possible antidotes for each one. And this material is available in a handout, which comes actually from the Introduction to Meditation class, and I'll elaborate on it a little bit in places. But I don't know if your experience is like this, but I find sometimes it's really useful to just reflect on the hindrances and how things didn't work out or as we hoped or whatever. And there, straight away, having a wish that something works out as I want is, it could be taken to be a form of sense desire, which is the first hindrance. After going through the hindrances, I'll allow, if there's anybody who has any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them, and then we'll do the meditation. And maybe in the meditation, you might keep an open mind as to whether any hindrances are arising for you, and whether you were able to deal with them through the antidotes. Then after the meditation's over, would be about half an hour, we'll go into a Q&A session. And then after that, we'll wrap up if there aren't any announcements. Any questions at this stage? Okay. Is anybody, I think there are a couple of people here, by the way, who are actually new to meditating. Are they just new to the Armadale group, or are they new to meditating as well?
I think probably fair to say they're probably just new to the Armadale group this evening, Richard.
Okay, fine. Well, at least someone's listening. So we settle into our meditation and it seems to settle down, takes a bit of time. I've been asked if there's a link to that handout, and it's from the Introduction to Meditation class. I will edit it if I can, and then send it to Marlene, hopefully. I will have to get permission to do this from Bianca, who organizes the Introduction to Meditation class, but I don't in principle see a problem. So what we find is we settle down, we get a little bit still in our meditation, and then we find that actually what's happening is that we're grasping on some sort of sense object. And we may notice that it's very pleasant, but it is pleasant, and that's why we keep grasping it. And we find that this becomes a real hindrance to our meditation. Instead of being able to give attention to the breath or whatever's happening, we're giving attention. In fact, we're probably lost in this pleasurable train of thought. And I've heard, for example, of a very experienced, very, very experienced meditation teacher who was saying that she was on a retreat, and she once planned out a whole dinner party in her meditation. And only then afterwards did she realize what was going on. So even really experienced teachers seem to have this problem too. So basically, why does this happen? Well, one reason is that we may become a bit bored of the meditation object. I mean, sometimes just watching breathing in and breathing out, or watching some other sensation in the body can be a little bit boring. If before we really sort of settle down into it, we may wish we could be somewhere else or whatever. And so we try and find distractions. And these distractions, well, as I mentioned, an example of going into a complete fantasy. She said afterwards she realized that it was complete rubbish, but she really enjoyed doing her plan of her dinner party at the time. So that was all, not only was it a fantasy, but also she was imagining the future. It's about the future, it's not about the present. Another possibility is that we remember some pleasant past experience. We remember that meal we had, or we remember a nice holiday, or we saw a movie and we enjoyed that. There are endless things that can just be much more pleasant to attract to. And it's really quite a challenge to deal with this. But what's the basic idea is to understand that and to contemplate on the fact that this just never seems to stop, at least in the early years of meditation for most people. It just goes on and on. As you probably are aware from Ajahn Brahm's teachings, we eventually may have a stage when the mind settles, and in fact the inner chatter pretty much ceases, or at least it is far less relentless. But this is the nature of the mind. It just goes on and on and on, and it's never really satisfied at all. And this is a, if we can see this endless nature of it, this is really good. This is really beginning to see the nature of what's driving us. It's just endless desire, greed, for want of a better word. The Buddha said greed, hatred, and delusion are the big problems. Well, this is greed writ large. It may not be greed in the sort of classic sense of the people on Wall Street or whatever, but it's just wanting, 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 wanting. And the whole purpose of Buddhism is in fact to understand that this is just suffering, and to find a way to end this suffering and to understand the cause of this suffering, which is in fact craving. And that's what Gita will be talking about in her thing, I believe, the four noble truths. So it's useful to be able to contemplate on that. And as we contemplate on that, we may start to get a little bit of, maybe not ill will, but we may feel, well, it's a bit of a waste of time. And we may find we have the motivation to go back to our primary object, probably the breathing. So that's the antidote for wanting, is to really start to understand and contemplate its nature in just never being satisfied. It's endless. So the next one we have to deal with, and these first two, sense desire, and the second one, hatred, ill will, annoyance, is also very common. And the other three are really rooted in, and they're variations of it. And so there are very typical things that happen. The mind basically comes, something arises in the mind and we don't like it. It's unpleasant. And we don't like it, and so we want to get rid of it. And this is how we just go through life. We like it and we want more, or we don't like it and we want to get rid of it. And this is not actually helpful, but we think it is. So there are lots of reasons for this. I mean, how often do you get irritated and annoyed by some noise that's going on. Someone won't be quiet. They're perhaps starting to snore, or they're breathing heavily if you're in a meditation retreat or sitting in a group, or it's too hot or it's too cold, or you've got pain in your joints, or your tummy is rumbling. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. We'll find something we don't want, and it's not perfect. Maybe we just don't like a mental object. We don't like the progress of our meditation, and it brings up aversion. And this is not, again, helpful, but we think it's helpful to deal with it by trying to get rid of it. So let's deal with the antidote. We, instead of trying to get rid of the unpleasant, we learn to develop tolerance and patience towards it and understand it. And if we can do this, gradually it starts to drive us as strongly as it did in the past. There's a lot we can investigate here. We can investigate why we feel aversion to something. We can investigate if we feel angry about something. We can investigate what anger feels like, because it's not actually a pleasant emotion. We think it is, but actually it's quite unpleasant when you start and look at it. And you can notice sometimes where these negative emotions, these unpleasant feelings, manifest in the body. There's cause and effect. And if there's a mental thing up here, there's a physical manifestation of that in the body. And with anger and ill will, you're fed up with the price of things, and you just wish that so-and-so wouldn't charge so much. And you feel aversion. Where do you feel that in the body? And understanding some of these feelings are actually quite unpleasant is really helpful. Another thing that's worth noticing about these unpleasant feelings and how to help develop tolerance and patience towards them is to understand what the Buddha talked about when he mentioned the two arrows, the two darts. And what this is that there's the physical, if you want to call it that, the physical pain we may suffer in our body. And then there's the mental reaction to it. And when we understand, and that's the two arrows, there's the actual suffering, the actual unpleasant sensation, and then there is the mental reaction to it. And it's this realizing this and realizing that nearly all the pain is actually mental pain and not the original pain is really, it's helpful. And there's a lot to investigate here. And if you have joint pain or anything like that, it can be really helpful to understand this principle, because immediately you can see the pain come up and then the mental proliferation doesn't kick in, and so it doesn't affect you so much. So we develop some sort of tolerance and patience towards this. I mean, if someone's gone to sleep, well, maybe they needed to go to sleep. Can we develop some compassion for them? Aren't you lucky you were able to sleep at last after all this time not being able to sleep? Maybe you'll have a great meditation afterwards because you slept. And so there are sometimes, there always in fact are, different ways of looking at the situation we feel we're confronted with. Because of the nature of delusion, we never really see it all that clearly. But if we look more carefully, there are often different ways to look at it. And so that brings me on to the next one, as I mentioned, sleepiness. And that is the third hindrance, which is sleepiness and sluggishness, or sloth and torpor, as how it has often been translated traditionally. And essentially what happens here is that the mind is very heavy and dull. We don't have much energy. And often we just want to go to sleep. And it's quite hard work fighting that off. There are techniques. If you feel like that, you might stand up, and that tends to mean you stay awake. Perhaps more a less invasive or irritating method for anybody else sitting around the room with you is to open your eyes. These things can help with low-level sleepiness. There is also the possibility and the probability, in fact, that you're just tired. You're just tired, so why not have a little sleep? Why not rest? And can you see that if you want to do this, how you might then start beating yourself up and saying, I shouldn't go to sleep, it's so bad. I must turn up to all my sessions. Give yourself the kindness to go to sleep and rest. And the chances are you'll have better sits, as in more productive perhaps, well, maybe not so productive, but probably less sleepy sleeps anyway, sits anyway. The main cause is sleepiness. And in the world we live in, the Western way of living, we're all pretty tired most of the time. When you go into the bush, it's really nice and peaceful, and we don't feel so tired. We're not invaded with so many really quite intrusive stimuli all the time. So sleepiness is a big thing. Everybody gets it from time to time, and you can try and fight it. But Ajahn Brahm is quite clear that in a retreat, maybe the best thing is to go and have a good rest. How many of you have been on a retreat and you find you sleep for the first day or two? Well, probably good for you. I've certainly done that. First week in a rains retreat, or 2 weeks or months. Restlessness and remorse. Now, this is the mind in a state of worry or agitation, and it can be quite distressing. You just can't let something go that you're worried about, or you may feel you did something wrong, or you know you did something wrong, and you feel remorseful about it. And these are quite common for people also to arise. You've got lots of energy, but you're not calm. Whereas in the sleepy state, it's so seductive. You just feel, oh, I feel so calm, so calm. But actually, you're not really concentrating. You're not really mindful of what's going on. You're just falling asleep. But it's pleasant. But restlessness and remorse is not, on the whole, very pleasant. It's we are worried. We are concerned about things we may have done. And because we have a lot of energy in this state, one of the things that's really helpful is to focus very carefully on some aspect and just stay with it and look at every bit of detail. So if we're naturally focusing, the mind is being drawn quite naturally to the breath, there is an awful lot of detail in looking at the start of the breathing in and the end of the breathing in and the start of the middle and the end of the middle and the start of the end of the end of the breathing in. And then there's gap, and then there's the same process for breathing out. And when you start to look at it, you'll notice that the beginning of the in-breath is not the same as the beginning of the in-breath, out-breath. And the end of the in-breath, where are the sensations there? And where are the sensations at the end of the out-breath? They're quite different. And if we really pay attention to this, it starts to get us more focused and mindful, and we hopefully can therefore relieve, for the purposes of meditation at any rate, the restlessness and remorse. And that, I think, is a technique that does seem to work quite well. You just have to have the presence of mind, really, to come to terms with the need, focus very carefully on one thing. There's another reason why that sort of antidote for restlessness and remorse works. And that is that if we're remorseful about something in the past, are we in the present moment? No. If we focus on something like really all the detail of the in-breath and the out-breath, we then are back in the present moment. And the Buddha taught that the present moment is the only thing that really matters. The only thing that matters. And the present moment is where we can overcome many things and be fearless for what's happening. It is just sensations and mind states arising and passing away. And then the last one is doubt. And there can be doubt about, have I got the right teacher? Is the teacher teaching me the techniques that are right for me? Does the teacher really know what they're talking about? All these sort of things come up. Usually the best thing to do with doubt is actually to go and talk to the teacher, because they're usually very easy, usually simple things that can be sorted out relatively easily or pretty easily. But there's no point in letting these things go on and on in your mind, because they don't really help. So sometimes, of course, the teacher, you know, if you've been meditating with that teacher for some time and following that teacher for some time, you may get to a point when you feel things just aren't really progressing for you. Well, sometimes the teacher may say, well, yes, this is the way it is, that it is actually a process of, as Ajahn has talked about, you've got the 5 days of the week, you get paid on Fridays, and you meditate on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and you get paid on Friday. We essentially have to understand that we don't get everything we want when we want it. And actually, that's the problem. It goes back, you see, to wanting in that case, back to the first sensual desire, sense desire. And with restlessness and remorse, remorse particularly, it may go back to the second one, which is hatred and ill will. So these are the five hindrances, and they are things that arise all the time for people. Usually we find that there's one or other that we get more of for time at any rate, and over a period of time it starts to wane, and that's fine and normal, I think. But there is also, if you're interested in, there's the Upakalesa Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and actually that talks about a whole load of other hindrances as well. But that was for people who are really exceptionally good meditators. The stories from there, the teaching from there, was the Buddha giving them to exceptionally good meditators. I think they were arahats already. The five hindrances are not absolutely the be-all and end-all, but the point is that they are very much the core, and they apply throughout one's meditation life, really. So are there any questions about this? Yes, one hand went up.
You happy for me to go, Chris?
Yes. Yep.
Thank you, Richard. With the contemplation of the mind, and you know the desire, you know the sense desires that might come up, how does one integrate that? Like, if we're doing breath meditation, and the whole aim is to calm the mind and to stop the chatter and so on. Yeah. How do we integrate that contemplation into that process? Like, how long do we do it for, or, you know, do we, yeah, can you explain?
I think that the contemplation can take place in the meditation, and also it's something useful to contemplate outside the meditation.
I see.
So, for example, it may be very useful to contemplate what's really going on in remorse, or what's going on in anger, or why do we, or sense desire. You know, we go to the supermarket, we just want this, and we want that, and we want the other. And so there's lots of contemplation one can do about that in the outside, outside of meditation. Inside meditation, as long as it feels natural, I think, is the answer. Sometimes just the sheer business about getting back into the present moment and realizing that, oh yes, this is a hindrance, and not getting lost in it.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah.
Sometimes the contemplation and the investigation is a much deeper thing. It might seem not very helpful to investigate the breath in great detail, but that process of investigating what's going on in great detail is gold. And we can do this with mind states as well as with sort of more run-of-the-mill hindrances as they arise. I think that it's always good to try and go back to your original meditation object, if you were doing samatha, for example. I think I would suggest not to contemplate too intensely, and to go back to the meditation once you feel a level of satisfaction and calmness and peace with it.
Yeah.
Peace with it has arisen. Okay?
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Thank you, Richard.
Okay. You're welcome. Anybody else want to ask a question? It's good. It's really good to ask questions, I think. It's how people learn.
I can't see any questions coming up at the moment.
Yeah, you have to give them, if I may suggest, it's always good to give people a few moments, because often they don't put their hands up straight away for one reason or another.
I do have another question, but I don't want to hog the discussion. So,
Chris, from my point of view, I've got I think a few moments still to answer questions before we fall seriously behind schedule.
No, you'll be fine if you would like to answer questions. So, Tony, why not?
Okay. And I hope that this is relevant. It doesn't necessarily relate to the five hindrances, or, well, perhaps. Reciting Buddha in meditation, I've come across that quite a bit through other teachers on YouTube, and I really only do take note of the monks in the forest tradition. Ajahn Kalyano was one that's talked about Buddha. And my question is, do you recite that verbally, or is it a mental recitation?
It would normally be mental.
Right.
Some people would do it verbally.
Yep.
It's obviously, normally in a group meditation environment, you wouldn't do it verbally.
Sure.
On the other hand, we verbalize the Metta Sutta very often, so there's a benefit sometimes. Mm-hmm. But no, we'd normally do it mentally. Buddha is one of the ones that is very powerful and works very well, as I recall Ajahn Brahm saying in Thailand.
Yeah. Ajahn Chah was apparently very, well, I was going to say into Buddha, but...
And yeah. Ajahn Tate talks about it, teaching the people near in the hills near Chiang Mai, how effective it was. But I think Ajahn Brahm's experience has been that for Western audience here in Perth, possibly other meditation, other mantras are better.
Sure.
You know, you can, sometimes some of the Metta Sutta can be helpful.
Okay. Or,
you know, good enough.
Yeah.
Or one, yeah. Another one is, I will die, that's for sure.
Well, I live alone, so it won't be strange if I chant that one.
We're getting a bit short, but we've got time for at least one question before the meditation.
Oh, yeah. Geeta, would you like to go ahead and ask a question?
The comment about Buddha, this is a comment in reply. I actually find that perhaps my Asian background is part of the reason, but when I'm quite unable to concentrate just on to be with the breath, I use the Buddha in breath, out breath as a way of bringing my attention back to the, and of course, only saying it mentally.
Yes.
But it seems to interrupt the flight into other chatter and stories. So I just wanted to make that comment that it's useful. The other thing was, you just mentioned Metta Chant, which I was going to bring up, because I've had quite a times of a lot of problems with enmity and anger as a hindrance during meditation. And of course, before you know it, I've gone into the story of what I'm going to tell this person when I next see them, and how dare they? And there's a big story. And then I realize, of course, I'm, you know, quite lost in this anger. So sometimes I have found that it's useful to actually chant the Metta Sutta or any Metta reflection before I even sit.
Yes.
To sort of soften the mind before I actually sit.
That's a wonderful contribution, in my opinion. I quite agree, something like Buddha or something on the in and on the out, two halves of a word, is really effective. And yes, metta is wonderful at the beginning or even beforehand, yes. And how we do it obviously depends on our individual styles. Yeah, great. Anything else? Or shall we go into, I think we should, because it's now 20 to 8.
I think that would be lovely, Richard, if you would like to lead us into meditation.
Okay. Right, well, the first thing, please, is to turn off your microphones, if you can. And now to get yourself very comfortable in your sitting position, whether it be on a chair or on a cushion or lying down or even standing for some. Please get yourself comfortable and pay attention to what it feels like and where the feeling, if there are any places in the body where it doesn't feel very comfortable. Usually when we first sit, it's not completely comfortable and we need to adjust. So the first thing to do is to adjust our seating or position, whatever it may be, sitting usually. And we may want to make a little resolution to ourselves, such as trying to notice the hindrances when they come up and try and deal with them. Or maybe the resolution to let go rather than push ourselves letting go is really, really important. And for some people, it helps to take one or two deep breaths at the beginning. And we can now look more systematically around our body for any areas of uncomfortableness. Let's start with our feet. Are they comfortable? Is there anything we want to change? Ajahn talks about giving these parts of the body that we're dealing with, like the feet, giving them metta. It's an act of kindfulness to relieve the tension and the pressure where possible. It's never going to be 100% perfect, but it becomes good enough. And then we can go to the legs, the knees, the thighs. We relax those. Do they need relaxing? And then the pelvis, is that, and the buttocks, is that comfortable? Do we need to shift a little bit? Cushion. On the back, the abdomen, the chest. Is there any tension there? How can we give it kindness? Settle it down. And then we have our hands. Where are they resting? Are they comfortable? Are the joints, the fingers soft and relaxed? Are our hands open? What about the wrists? Are they okay? And then the forearms and the elbows and the upper arms. And then then is the shoulders. The neck. Often there's a lot of tension in the neck. Does such a lot of work. Can we give it compassion? Be grateful to it for holding our head all these hours of the day. And then with the head itself, we can relax the nose and the lips, the tongue, jaw, around the eyes, ears, and even the top of the head. And now, lastly, we could just look over the whole body again and ask, are you okay? Is there anywhere that needs a bit of attention? Now, just pay attention to whatever is coming up. Is it breathing now? Are we ready to turn to the breath? Noticing breathing in. if you find your attention wandering, gently bring it back to the meditation object. Breathing in. Some people may wish to use the last few minutes of the meditation to give themselves metta and to wish all of us and all beings happiness and peace. And now, in the last few moments of the meditation, it's helpful to reflect on how the meditation went. What were the things that worked for you? what were the things that did not work so well? How did you feel before the meditation at the start and at the start? And how do you feel now? Feel better or worse? What? And then when you're ready, gently come out of meditation, open your eyes and look around and see how things are. Imagine a gong. Ding, ding, ding. Okay, so this is now meant to be time to ask any questions. Maybe about hindrances or daily meditation practice or anything else, really.
Gloria would like to ask a question. Gloria, would you like to unmute yourself?
Yeah, so I had like pretty much bad anxiety, and for most of the time I'm worried about everything all the time, and like I know that the future is not true and the past has gone, but like my feeling is like I think they are true, and I have this like intense anxiety all the time. So I think most of my meditation, I cannot really do any breathing meditation because I just cannot calm myself down. So my present ways of doing is that I just do nothing, and I will feel like the anxiety keep running over my head, and I want to ask, what can I do about it, or should I not do anything about it, and how to really like calm myself down? Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear that you have this anxiety, but it's very, 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 very common, and you're not alone by any means. So this is hopefully of some comfort. It's not just you. Many people have anxiety. And looking at you in the screen, I guess that you're relatively young. And I think that the stage of life you may be at is a time when often we are quite anxious. So this is normal life. Some of us are more prone to anxiety than others. I'd like to ask how you do your meditation, first of all.
I just do nothing, and I will just sit there, and I will like, I don't know what I have done, but I think I didn't like do anything. I will like observe my thoughts, and then I will see all those images about the future and the past, and they were just running through, and I will observe them, and because I don't know what can I do about it. So
that's helpful to hear that.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I slightly cut you off there. Did you finish your answer?
No. It's just I don't think I do anything because I cannot do anything. I will say that. Like if I try to focus on my breath, I will have this feeling that I'm like controlling my anxiety, and then it will become like more, it will become like bigger. But even if I don't control it, it is already very big. So I don't know what can I do about it, actually. Yes.
Well, tell me that I shouldn't ask this question if you don't want. But I've just done something on the five hindrances. Did you notice any hindrance come up?
I think like it's like restlessness.
Yes, I think restlessness and worry and all that, yes. Now, the way to try and deal with this is actually to try to get back into the present moment. And what you need, in my view, or what we need when we have this, and it's very often our thoughts run away with us so much, we don't have the presence of mind to do something about it. But what we need to do is actually slow ourselves down and focus on the detail. But the detail of our thoughts are often not helpful to us. What's more helpful for many, many people is to focus on what it feels like in the body. And there are ways you can do this. You can either focus on the breathing. And as I mentioned, the there's a lot of things you can look at in the breathing, such as the beginning and the end of each, the in-breath and the beginning and the end of the out-breath. There's all that you can do, but if you find the breath doesn't work for you, another thing you can do is try to find what the physical sensation in your body is. Because these mental sensations, these mental states, whether they're anger or whether they're anxiety or whether they're happiness or wanting of some sort, they all have manifestations in the body. And if we can train ourselves to understand what the feeling feels like in the body, we've just taken ourselves one step away from our thoughts, and the thoughts are very often the problem. So really being able to find out as a first step what it feels like in the body. Do you feel it in the body? What does it feel like? And then where do you feel it? And then give it metta. So I sometimes get anxious. I've had a lot of anxiety in my life. And one of the things is that it tends for me to come up in my tummy. And you may find there's some area where this anxiety comes up for you. And in which case you can be kind to that area. You can perhaps almost literally kiss it better if it's your, if your tummy's sort of anxious. You can perhaps rub it gently, like your mum might have rubbed it if you were a sick child. This is giving yourself metta. Ajahn Brahm has a very good story about this, about a student who was very bright, but had terrible anxiety to the point when she couldn't study and get out of the house. And so Ajahn advised her when she phoned up the first time, and he knew this person through various means, that they're, you know, family and stuff in the past. And he advised her, do you feel it in the body? And then where do you feel it in the body? And then when he said, he was then able to suggest that she gave it kindness. And this worked a treat. It's one of his stories about the person was in Adelaide, I think. And I won't go into more detail now, but the point is that really getting to understand what it's like in the body can be really helpful. And if Ajahn Brahm teaches samatha, but if you were to try doing some vipassana, particularly vipassana on the sensations in the body, and this is what I learned in Burma over about 15 years, you really begin to understand where it comes up in the body. And that immediately takes it away from what's going on in the mind. And then after a long, long, long time, you may begin to be able to see, oh, this is an unpleasant sensation. And once you can see that it's unpleasant, that produces a whole new realm of letting go. And so there are ways in which meditation can help. It requires practice. This is not something that is just a panacea, but it does work. I know that from personal experience. So I would just say, I advise you to focus when this happens on the sensations in the body. And sometimes sensations in the body can be very pleasant. Piti sukha can come up and so on. But that's my suggestion for what it's worth.
Mm. Thank you, Richard. We also have a suggestion in the chat that sometimes meditation might not be enough to meet the challenges of what we're facing. So basically, psychotherapy can give us comfort and assistance, a good counselor who we can trust and who we feel empathy with can also help us go through these things as well and learn. I know for me personally in the past that I have actually had some wonderful counselors who have helped me through some difficult phases. And also I think also sometimes our goals maybe need to be set just as very small goals. Can I stay today? Can I do 1 minute?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Can I do maybe 1 minute 30 seconds tomorrow? And making our practice just very gentle on ourselves. It's very important as well. Thank you, Richard.
Can I just respond to
yes,
that?
Yes, please.
I've certainly been in that position myself, and I wholeheartedly support what you say. But a lot of people probably don't need that, or even if they do, they don't necessarily find it instantly available. But I wholeheartedly support what you say. But I also really think focusing on the body can be very helpful too.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Also, we have a comment here. Any tips on how to maintain a daily meditation in our lay life? Richard.
Well, the first point is it really varies from individual to individual. There are some people who are just very good at meditating first thing in the morning, and they do it for a certain length of time that they find they've got available, and they just do it pretty much every day, and it works really well for them. Other people don't have that for one reason or another. So they may just meditate when they really feel they need to meditate. But gradually they find that it becomes more of a regular practice. One thing I did for a long time was I would try and meditate doing metta or whatever for about 10 minutes before going, or 20 minutes sometimes, before I went to sleep or went to bed. I found that particularly helpful. But you have to find what works for you during the day. And another thing that can work is if you join a meditation group, because it gives you a scheduled thing in the week. And sometimes it may feel a bit of a burden to turn up to these scheduled things. But the thing is that it really is very, very, it's very helpful. The energy of a group really sort of brings things along. So that would be a second tip. There's lots on the web, in groups on the web, like the Armadale group. Keep coming.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly with you, Richard. Yeah. I find this is a very good way to focus my week. We have a comment here too. Timing of the day can also impact on your meditation. So for me, I find a time is early morning, and I can keep to that time. It's a time when I'm not disturbed, and I do it lying on my bed because that is easy for me to do, and it's comforting for me to do.
Yes, and there's another, yes.
Please, Richard.
There is another way, actually. If you're in driving, I learned this from, I think his name is Eric Harrison in Perth. But basically, when you stop at a red light, instead of just being worried about what you've got to do or whatever, you can actually go into a little meditation when you're not driving, when you're stuck in the traffic lights, and you can pay great attention to the lights in front of you and the detail on the car and the number plate and things like that, or the sounds around you. And this just is a 1 minute little exercise, and it just brings you back to something a bit more centered. And from this sort of 1 minute thing, one can develop moments during the day when you just bring yourself back. It might be you go and have a coffee somewhere and you just spend a moment just sitting and relaxing. So there are these very short little moments when you get centered again. I think Ajahn Brahm calls them the in-between moments. Or has called them that. And they're very, very useful. They give you a little bit of a perk during a pep up in the middle of the day.
Well, thank you, Richard. Martha's been very patiently waiting. Martha, would you like to unmute yourself and ask a question?
Yes, please. I was just wondering about, hold on, go back. I like notes, it helps me remember better. Because I've been really wanting to know more about the five hindrances. I'm just wondering when it comes to restlessness, remorse, worry, and also, is it ever, do y'all think it's ever helpful to go back into the past and say, for example, make a list of all people we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all?
Not during your meditation, for sure.
Yeah, off the mat.
Yeah.
Because whatever I do on the cushion, I try to take into my actual life. But yeah, I know y'all are talking about as it relates to being
grounded. I think there's a general principle here that if you've harmed someone, whether intentionally or unintentionally, it's very good to recognize that and make peace with the individual concerned. That's a good general principle. Getting quite old now and so on, I feel that probably, you know, there are people that I feel perhaps one wants to do a general forgiveness with, you know. I'm one day I'll die and my family, my brothers will die. And, you know, it's good to seek forgiveness and for anything one may have done, any harm one may have caused, hurt one may have caused intentionally or unintentionally by body, speech or mind. Forgiveness is a good thing to do. And maybe that's better than making a formal list. I think sometimes there are some things that come up in one's mind, you know, they come up fairly regularly. The same sort of scenario just seems to come up over and over again. And I think that's well worth investigating from a Dharma perspective I'm talking about here.
Repeated themes and whatnot.
Yeah. There's a whole wealth of Dharma there. You know, it's causes and conditions. What something causes it to come up, and it's, you know, what is that? It's usually about oneself. And so you get to the idea of anatta. Is it really you? Is it just causes and conditions? And is it permanent or does it go away? And for sure it's dukkha. You know, it's just...
That's helpful because, you know, I'm always trying to do what I'm doing on the cushion in actual life. But what I hear you saying is that it's not necessarily helpful to just forego the past altogether. It's not like we're trying to forget about the past per se. It's just being present with it so that we can act more skillfully in the present moment and not be laden with the causes and conditions that caused us to be unskillful before. Is that what? But at the same time, go back and if there's a repeated theme coming up.
Well, I think that trying to answer that point that we all basically try and learn as we go along about acting more skillfully. The Buddha said that sila, ethical conduct, is the beginning of the whole path, really. And so developing this so that we don't cause harm is a really essential thing. Of course, we all do, unintentionally sometimes, but we try to avoid the intentional stuff.
I can't remember how to spell sila. Is it S-I-L-A?
S for sugar, I for indigo, L for lima, A for apple.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Welcome.